and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, coming to you from the sweetest place north of Georgia, a place where they say even God Almighty stayed when he took a vacation, except he seemed to skip this rundown studio entirely. Now today on this, I like using that voice. Now today.
It almost sounded wise.
I almost sounded wise for a second, then I'm not. Now, today on the show, we are finishing our three-part look into legendary Motown artists from the 1960s and what they were doing in the 1970s. Now, we're not concentrating on what they did in the 1970s, like what they ate or anything like that, but the musically,
no,
what they
the
were
music.
Doing. Yeah.
Because you concentrate all the other aspects of life.
Look. You gave me that look. No, really. It's just the music.
I'm trying to hedge off of the past before you go on to a tangent.
I like that. The look that you can see it. You'll see it when we do our... What is that?
That thing? When you talk and it's on the interweb.
Yeah, the podcast that will be on the interweb. But he gave me this look like he was totally serious. Like, no, we're not going to talk about their food habits. Like, no, seriously. Okay. And we end this series with the legendary Stevie Wonder and his 1972 album Talking Book, or as I call it, that book there that done started speaking.
And people at the record store knew and know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, it's that idiot. Yeah, I know what he's talking about. Now, if you remember from last week's show, this is quite a long time ago because we've taken a break because we had some technical problems.
We had to purchase some new
equipment. So this may not seem timely to us. It really matters little to you people, other than you'll be hearing this in the fall. But last week's show, I was recovering from sunstroke. I don't even remember that anymore. It was so long time ago. And a haircut. I remember the haircut because it still looked good. And both are doing fine now. My sunstroke is gone, and the haircut is still looking good. Cut a little bit too much, but I liked it. I just want to point out something quickly before we start, that I received an email this week that wanted to know if Rob had mental problems. And let me say, even if he did, I'm not going to say so on this show, but let's just say the boy don't learn as fast as the other kids.
And sometimes at Christmas, I get coloring books.
When he climbs to the top of a tree, he doesn't quite get there. when he takes a drive out in the country, he runs out of gas, if you know what I mean. But I would never throw Rob under the bus and say that he's not as normal as everybody else here. That's all I'm going to say.
Nope, never been diagnosed.
Anyway, to understand what I'm talking about, I'm going to let Rob speak for himself and tell us what he did during this past week.
This past week I had a party and lots of beautiful women came by and then they left and then the party was over and I cleaned up and I went to work the next day. And it was, it was something else. That was stuck in my memory. Best work ever. I think I'm going to get a raise or maybe a gold watch from the work I've done. And the party, that was pretty good too. You can't not like a good party, right? I can like a good party.
I made him talk as long as he could. And he was as bad as I thought he would be.
Maybe worse. Maybe worse. If things happen in my life, I wouldn't have to make things up.
What he said wasn't true because nothing happened to him this week. Dullsville. Okay. So now that all of you have, as usual, suffered through the first 5 minutes of the show and are wondering why we're not on the gardening channel.
We get 5 minute listens and then boom, off to the gardening station.
It's time for Odds and Ends. Before we start Odds and Ends,
We got some.
Let's just say that we have a new sponsor. We are sponsored by Spitfire.
Spitfire.
The musical innovation that has not been used since the 1960s. Spitfire.
A little bit complicated.
So we thank Spitfire for coming out of the woodwork after 60 years to sponsor our show. So it's time for odds and ends. Lost time is not found again. This week on Odds and Ends, it's kind of, it's a little interesting. It's not much interesting. It's not fascinatingly interesting. But I find this, what happened, interesting. I was driving on my car radio. I was driving in my car and listening to the radio, and the classic song Maggie May by Rod Stewart came on the radio. And you know what? You wouldn't know because you don't drive. The government won't issue you a license because of some mental incapabilities.
No, I just get picture ID. It's called an operator's license.
Yeah, but I don't which says, you know, mental disability and whatever. And
he's probably not dangerous.
But when you're driving, like when you're actually driving, moving the vehicle, you have the music in the background, but you can't concentrate. Like we would concentrate when we're listening to records to review on this show.
Yeah, whenever you're listening at home.
Yeah, exactly. But when you're at a red light, there's really nothing to do but to listen and concentrate on the music because it's first of all, it's like a billion degrees outside. And you want to concentrate on anything but the heat and driving and everything. So anyways, Maggie May was playing. And this is the classic Maggie May, number 130 in Rolling Stones as the greatest song of all time. I would actually put that in the top 50, but whatever. What I noticed when I was listening was actually very interesting to me. In that, in the part where probably three quarters of the way through, where you're getting to the end of the song, where the music stops and then it goes with the acoustic guitar that Ron Wood is playing, and then there's the mandolin playing. I hope everybody can visualize it. If not, listen to the song after the show, and you'll get what I mean. And there's the part where it's just like just those playing. And then you hear kind of like the bass kind of come in, and Rob says, "Oh, Maggie." That wasn't very good. It sounded like, "Oh, Daddy boy.
Oh, Maggie. Maggie.
Come back, Maggie." And what I found interesting was, first of all, I thought the faces do play on this except for Ronnie Lane. Ronnie Wood plays like three guitars on here. He plays the electric and the 12 string. And he also plays the bass guitar. I thought that Ronnie Lane of the Faces played bass guitar on this, but it's actually Ron Wood. I could always almost tell a lead guitarist playing bass because they play very rudimentary, but they play very rhythmic. And you hear that when Keith Richards, like if Bill Wyman didn't show up for a session, this happens quite a bit. You know, the Stones have no patience or allegiance. If Bill was sick that day, then Keith would play it, and he'd play like he played the part in Sympathy for the Devil, where it goes dum 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 dum. You know, they play a very rhythmic, almost lead guitar type part, instead of coming up with kind of like a really cool part that bass player would come up with.
Yeah, they kind of play more like they'd want to hear.
Yes.
If the bass player wasn't such a weirdo.
Exactly. So I'm listening to this, and it's just coming out of the speakers really loud, like. There's the guitar, and then there's a little bit of electric guitar, and then there's the mandolin, and then the bass comes in, and it goes boom. See, I'm trying to assimilate it. You really have to hear it, but it comes in really loud. It's really cool. Boom, 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 boom. You know
you just do that slide in the whole notes.
Yes, exactly. And it's really amazing. And then I noticed as it goes along, maybe like if even 30 seconds later the instruments take over, and what that means, and the bass is not as loud, is that there's a subtle, and you don't get to hear this much when you're paying attention to music, the old slider on the mix, putting the bass down just at the perfect time. I mean, it's an art form. Yeah. And we're going to talk about this more, about the mixing process, because the mixing process, especially when we started to do it, was like all hands on deck. And you had to move things throughout the 4 minutes, or God forbid you had an 8 minute song. And you had to do it. If you did it once correctly, or kind of correctly, you would have the automatic faders do it for you after that for certain parts. And so you'd want to get, you'd have like eight people with their hands on the drums because, or four people with their hands on the drums because you have to put the switch on. That's
right, doing the fade outs. I remember that at the end.
And then you would, when the drums would stop playing or something would stop playing, you'd have to press a button and it would cut out the bass or whatever because you don't need it anymore. You had to do all, it was
all manual. I remember when I first saw boards with the automated faders, they were called flying faders.
Right. And it was difficult, but it was a lot of fun, and you had a lot of laughs because you made a lot of mistakes sometimes. I miss those days because now, of course, even us at the, right after that, we got into the, like, everything does it by itself and blah, blah, blah. And it kind of takes the fun out of it. Then you just make decisions. But it's rare that you get to hear it, like the actual thing go lower. And you don't get to hear it go lower, but how precise a song has to be in a mix. The bass should be loud here. This is an arrangement, I guess, is what we're talking about. The bass has to be loud here because we want it loud. But then after that first time they do it, we got to put it down so that the other instruments take over. And
you hear it a bit, but you feel it.
Yeah. Yes, you feel it, but you don't hear it. I heard it, luckily, because I was paying attention. And you could actually hear, like, I wanted to hear the bass. And then I couldn't all that much anymore. Because I love the bass on it. Doom, 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 doom. Trying to assimilate it, but I'm not. And I wanted to hear it again. I said, I love that. I could hear that, for the rest of the song. And then when I went to go hear it the second time, it was like, ooh, I can hardly hear it.
The mandolin's up more.
Yes, exactly. And I found it fascinating is that for all these years, and I've listened to Maggie May since 1977 constantly, because it's always on the radio, especially when in the late 70s, like Maggie May was always on the radio. And so I've heard it thousands of times, and that's the artistry of a mix, is to be able to put an instrument down but not know it. Unless you're following along, you're like, oh, with the bass, and you're going like, oh, I like the bass so much. You would notice it then. But if you're listening to the whole song, you should not notice anything go down. It should be almost like the whole song simpatico. And I just want to, it's a little footnote, but it's a little segue into when we do our talk about mixing. Because mixing is so important. It's like editing a movie after it's been shot, because they say that a movie is made in the editing room, and I totally agree that an album is either made or broken in the mixing
stage. In the mixing, what was the band we were listening to that, was it Shoes? That Mutt Lang did three of the songs, and you could hear the difference in the mixes.
What? Records.
The records.
Yes. Yeah. Very close, because it was the pop. It was the power pop.
Yes. Yeah. That's the time I remember it.
And yes, you could actually tell that the three songs that Mutt Lang did stood out from the other songs. You could hear it.
Yeah.
And that's how important, like, you can actually make things really lively in a mix, because you can make the guitar sound a different way.
They have an ear to know when to accent the things that need to be accented. Some guys got it, some guys don't.
Oh, yeah. And it is not as easy. There are people, and they always, I'm going to stop, because we're going to talk about all of this when we, and it won't be soon, unfortunately. We got, at least for the next three or four shows, I've got those kind of booked up. But in about a month and a half, we're going to talk about mixing, and we're going to talk about all we want to talk about with mixing that we want to put in. It is an art form, just like mastering is, just like how to record is. And unfortunately, it's kind of too easy nowadays. It was a lot more fun when I tell you, I loved mixing. I loved being on the hands-on in the board. I loved that. I know that it's a lot of pressure, because you got you got like the engineer wanting you not to fuck up, and you got the drummer better not fuck up. And,
time in there is a whole lot more money than time outside the studio.
Oh, a great point by Rob. You fuck up, you may have cost everybody $70 just for that. Or at least half of that, about $35 for a half hour.
For another half hour.
So, it's fun, but there was a lot of pressure. Like, yeah, if you had a record company behind you, it's not that much pressure, but holy smokes. Like, you don't want to spend a whole bunch. You just spent a whole bunch of money recording the album. You didn't want somebody to keep on fucking up.
What would we do? Maybe like a week for recording and a day for mixing?
2 days for mixing. Usually half the songs one day and half the songs next. Yeah. And a lot of time it was, and the only time you needed everybody at a mixing, because there should only be two people at the most at a mixing, because everybody wants their parts high, right?
Yes.
You need somebody neutral to kind of like
both say, their own worst critic and their own best spokesman.
Exactly. So you want one guy, which is always me, or at the best two guys. So if the one guy is not sure, he can go to the next guy, which is usually Rob, and he would go, I'll do it again. I don't think so. But the first day, when you're trying to knock things out, that's the day everybody's got to be there, because all hands on board. I don't know if you do that in the mixing or if you do that in the pre-mixing where you just want to, I don't remember. But anyways, you do have to have everybody there. You can't have two guys on 16 channels.
using their feet. It looks foolish.
Oh, those are the days. So those were great. I just love that. Anyways, little tidbit that turned into quite a segment for odds and ends. As usual, everything always turns into something a little bit larger on this show. Today we are going to finish our segment from last week, which seems like weeks ago,
but it seems that way,
doesn't it? About how to make a vinyl record. Now, if you want to hear part one, then listen to last week's episode, because we're going to go and start right from where we ended off a week ago, and see, where we are.
If it were me, I'd be avant-garde, and we'd do part four right now, and then we'd get to part three, and we'd give part two a miss.
Yeah, don't confuse people by talking.
But it's not me.
Because you confuse people. You confuse me. Let's go to part four, and it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Okay.
There's no part four. Shut up.
Now, when we left off, we had created the master disc, and that went through inspections and to putting the grooves on and everything. So we've created the master disc, right?
Oh, yeah.
I hope everybody remembers that. I do really hope that you just go back and listen to that. If you really are interested, go back and listen to the part one. If you don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Or you could be listening to this right after last show. And then it's nothing. But we were making the grooves and everything and the spaces in the middle. We had done that. That's the master discs. Now we're creating the stamper is what we're doing.
The stamper. The stamper's the thing, if I'm correct. It's in a factory there and they put a blob of liquid vinyl down. It's hot. It's all steamy. And then the stamper comes down and smashes it and turns into a record. Would that be right?
Sure, let's. So,
perhaps not. Continue then.
We're not. you may be right, but first we're creating. We're not off creating the individual pressings yet. We're not doing that. There's still one more disc that needs to be created. Okay, we've created the master disc with the grooves and everything and the songs and blah 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 and the individual, if there is individual spaces between songs. Now the disc called the stamper is made from the master disc and the one that'll be used to stamp the grooves onto the vinyl copies we buy in the store. So you're kind of right.
Okay, so it does stamp.
It does stamp the grooves into the master
disc. Good, I'm glad it's called a stamper.
Now, depending on how many copies are ordered, multiple stamper records may be needed to be created or need to be created as they wear down over time. So you create quite a few stamper.
Like in any kind of production work, like machinery, it wears over time.
Especially if you're like a Fleetwood Mac and make 2 million records right off the bat.
Yeah.
You're going to need a lot of stamper because it wears down every time you use it. toom, as it comes down.
Yeah, you want a record pressed early in the stamping, I figure.
Oh, it says right here, one stamper disc is used for every 1,000 records.
Oh, really?
Produced. Yeah.
So that's a lot of stamper discs. A million to press, you need 1,000 stamper discs.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And trust me, in the days of the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of people who would need how many would you need for like a million? 1,000? Yeah, you would need 1,000.
What did you say? Each one does 1,000?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you're selling like 14 million albums, that's 14,000 stamper discs.
Wow, that's hard to believe. Wow. I was thinking you need 10 and here you need like 1,400 or whatever. Unsurprisingly, the process for creating stamper discs is just as complex as it is for creating the Lacquer Master. And you guys remember the Lacquer Master. If not actually more so, this may be actually the most complex of the discs to make. Once the master disc has the music files imprinted onto it, be they analog or digital, it's washed to remove any debris, as we said before.
Yeah, you got to keep it dust-free.
Exactly. Sprayed with liquid silver. You don't want any dust on the record because you're making a million copies of.
Yeah, it's like starting the record with a scratch.
Yes, exactly. So you wash it again to remove any excess silver, and then sprayed with tin chloride and all that stuff to make it really like sparkling and
clean. No mistake, clean down. Molecular level.
Like going through like one of those washes that they put you through when you go into space or something.
Oh yeah, and you come back and maybe you got radiation and they got a strip and they scrub you down with that.
And then you don't have radiation anymore.
Then you don't have any radiation. Use their Geiger counter.
I'm sorry, I hit the table. I hope that didn't.
It did not.
Kill anybody.
We fixed yours, mine's, I can't hit the table.
Okay, from there, the master enters the electroforming process, also called electroplating, in which it is... This is interesting. All of this is so interesting, at least this for me and Rob. I hate if everybody's listening to it and don't know about records and are going, I don't give a shit. electroplating, in which the record is submerged in a nickel bath, which is so fascinating to me. So complicated to make a record. I thought you just went like this, Rob, and you put the grooves in, boom, let's go.
That is your record. Trim the edges.
Way to go, kids. This part is key, as the nickel creeps into every groove on either side of the discs and bonds to it by an electrical charge.
Yeah.
Fuck, this is fascinating.
It's like electroplating. Yes. They do like baby shoes.
That's why it's called electroplating. And that's exactly what it is. This is fascinating.
I took that in chemistry there.
This is actually more fascinating than I thought it was when I picked this segment. It really is, at least for us. The nickel siding is then removed. You remove the nickel side and you're left with two discs. The master disc and the newly formed electroplated disc called the father disc. I didn't know that. I had no idea. I thought I knew everything about this. I know almost nothing about making records. What's noteworthy is that the father disc sports outward ridges instead of the carved grooves of the masters. Wow. Outward ridges instead of the inward.
Oh, yeah. Master. Okay. So
yeah. This is the disc template that'll be used to stamp that particular album's copies. So the father disc, that's the main disc used as the stamper disc for...
And the nickel is harder than what they were using, so it can put up with a bit more stamping.
Wow, that's interesting. There is a mother disc. When you repeat it, this time with use the father disc, we repeat what you've just done, to create a mother disc which has grooves just like the Lacquer Master does. So the father disc has it on the outside, and the mother disc has it just on the inside, just like the Lacquer Master.
Yeah, the father disc is kind of like a plaster cast of some of a footprint or something.
Yes, exactly. mother discs are used to create the stamper discs, which are what's used to create individual vinyl records, aka the final product. Ah, I get it. The father creates the mother, and the mother is the one that's used, right?
But you could.
I know that. So I'm just hoping
with the
you understand.
Mother, because then you'd create another father.
Yes, exactly. because you can't use a father disc because it has outside grooves. So you, what you do...
Would is you, you use the mother disc to create another father disc? Is that what's going on here?
Let's see. Let's create stamp. Let's use to create individual IK. Of course, final stampers get the center hole punch for prosthetic and have excess material trimmed off.
Okay, that's off the sides, yeah.
Yeah, it would just be the mother. The mother discs are the only one used. It's not, it doesn't answer your question. I think only one father disc is made, but you make other mother discs, I think. Obviously, you make other mother discs because you use 1,000 of them. Mother discs are basically the ones that you throw away after 1,000 listens, after 1,000 stamps.
Yeah, but the mother discs have the grooves going inside. Therefore, if they stamped against vinyl, you would create a vinyl with
Well, it kind of says here, Rob, grooves. To be honest with you. It kind of says here. It says, naturally, both father and mother discs undergo quality inspections, and additional stampers can be created from the mother disc as needed. So the father disc pretty much stays as is.
The father disc is the one that you stamp because it is the inverse, the mirror copy of the one that you are putting on the turntable. And the mother disc is used to create more father discs, the 14,000 you need for your 440 million zillion
copies. And as it says, that this stamper, which is the mother disc, is usually only good for a few hundred records. Now they only see 100 records.
Well, I think if you got a mother disc, it's making like a few hundred father discs, which then multiplies to
Very interesting. So much more complicated than I thought. This is an unbelievable process to make a vinyl record, and I mean unbelievable in fascinating terms. Now we're going to, I think, pretty much one of the last steps here, which is kind of like the second last step. You're actually pressing the vinyl. When the stamper is ready to go, it's time to bust out that vinyl. Just bust it out.
Bust it out.
Like you're busting a groove.
Go to that box and bust out the vinyl.
Literally. It says literally here. Literally bust out the vinyl. Individual records start off as polyvinyl chloride, PVC, pellets.
Okay.
These are transparent by default, but you can add colorant to create the traditional black vinyl records or more unique and colorful pressing. Now, we should tell you that what I know since I was like 12 years old is that colored records look fantastic. Yep. I remember Elvis having they did almost all of them as blue when he did his last album, Moody Blue. And everybody thought that was great. In fact, I bought one of the first records I ever bought was when the Moody Blues got back together and did Octave. And I was there the first week. And I never had a blue record. Did you get a copy of that?
I got a copy. And if you hold it up to the light and the light reflects off it, it also has that that picture.
Yes. It is cool. But I have always learned, or I don't know if it's a myth or if it's true or not, that colored records compared to black records not sound as good, which is why, other than when I was a kid, and actually Moody Blue by Elvis Presley and Octave by the Moody Blues was almost the only way to get it. There are copies, I think, of that, but they actually did the reverse and made the major amount of records they made blue. And strangely enough, they did it within a year because Moody Blue was released in 1977 and an Octave was in the middle of 1978. So usually those are used as specialty unless when you want to buy a record and you might not play it, but you got it in blue or yellow or whatever.
Okay,
but I've always heard, and I swear it's the truth because I've heard it so many times, is never buy a colored record other than black to listen to because it just doesn't sound as good as the black one. It's more for collectors than.
I wonder if there's something they put in the black one that maybe makes it last longer. Or?
I think so. There's a lot of things about, you know, a lot of technical terms about making it into a cake and a biscuit, which, you know, it's all kind of the terms of 320 degrees, which we're not going to get into. And then you just put the record on that you have after you put on like a, like you've squeezed it into it's really complicated. I'm not going to get into it because nobody's going to care, but you do some stuff to the vinyl record and then you put it on the hydraulic press. The stampers are then placed on either side of it like two pieces of bread on a sandwich, And before the actual pressing happens, the album layer label is centered onto the puck, which is the center of the printer. It's interesting to note the labels aren't actually glued onto the record after it's pressed. They're squished into place by pressure. That's interesting. They're not, you don't just go and glue it on the center of the record, the label.
The bonds with the paper or whatever they use.
Yeah. And they actually bake it beforehand. This is so complicated. This is so many things about making a vinyl record that I never knew. See, you have to bake the label at 250 degrees Fahrenheit to remove any moisture or bubbling when you put the thing on.
Yeah, yeah, you can't have moisture. That's off-gassing. Right. Off-gassing.
Which I've never seen. But of course, I've never seen bubbling or anything like that. And it always seems so precise. And I guess it is because they have a presser doing it and they put it at 125 degrees.
I tell you, I'm curious at this point to know how many the records they can stamp in what amount of time. How long does it take to... Do they mention that?
So far, they don't mention that. We're going to see what... Once you've got the label and everything on it, then the pressing commences. You've got it all set. The two stampers come together, as we said, like a sandwich, at about 2,000 PSI. That's about the level of pressure medium-duty pressure washers use for cleaning. Okay. Initially, the press reaches 300 degrees Fahrenheit, but then the vinyl is cooled to a mere 100 degrees. Yeah, only 100 degrees. That's pretty fucking hot.
Still have to throw up the handle.
During this process, the stamper ridges push into the hot malleable vinyl to create the grooves. Oh, that's interesting. The label is also squashed into place here at the same time. After, a separate machine makes a quick pass to remove excess vinyl, often reused for future records. I didn't know they had excess vinyl when you press the record down. You had excess vinyl.
Yeah, I imagined that. So I was thinking, is if it does it squish out the ends? Because they can't have the perfect amount there.
Right.
Air has to escape. And as air is escaping, once all the air is gone, then some vinyl is going to squish out.
We got to hurry this because I still got some. We're so fascinated by it. We're taking so long. I don't want to go into a third show because that's really pushing our audience here. So let's see. So now we're going to the test pressings and quality assurance during each batch of pressings, which means if you press 500,000, that would be a batch. A quality assurance check is performed. A few random albums are created and played by an employee called test pressings. We know all about test pressings. They want to know how it sounds after everything's been done.
Yeah, when I was working the pill factory there, they'd take random bottles and just check them for weight and
same thing,
moisture and bacteria.
To ensure there aren't any significant problems and everything sounds good, just like you would in any type of factory, you just take a couple of the samples and see, okay, how is it working right? Test pressings also get shipped to the artist. And I know this, I got a test pressing for a couple of our albums. Also get shipped to the artist, producer, and music label for approval. I never got to approve anything.
Yeah.
I just got it sent to me. They never said, do you approve of it? It was once we shipped it off, that was out of our hands.
You weren't part of the process from that
point. No, it was the artist didn't seem to matter when it came to approving of anything. Because trust me, I wouldn't have approved a couple of masters that we did if I was involved in the approval method. The approval process is different for every album and artist. Depending on the vinyl press company, and likely a slew of other circumstances, a digital copy of the randomly selected albums can also be created and emailed to save some time. But this isn't ideal. Once everything is approved, the newly created records are given the green light for mass production. And it seemed like if you're a big record company and a big artist, then you have three or four people approving on it. If you're a small independent artist like us, the guys that are making it... are approving of it.
Maybe. Maybe they're doing it. Maybe they're not. We don't know.
We're in the black, and I swear to God, we made like 6 records, and we didn't get choice of approving out of anything. We just got set.
There you go. It's done. Enjoy. Where's is it check clearing? The check cleared. Okay.
You kids and your records. So, anyways, so here we are at the final step in this incredible process, and it is an incredible process. Pressed records are placed manually into their inner sleeves and outer album cover. There's no machine that puts it in there. It's actually a person that puts it in. This process doubles as yet another quality checkpoint and ensures that the final product isn't scratched, dropped.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because people loading the records actually get to visually see them.
Exactly. They actually look at it and then put it into the record sleeve. Yeah.
I remember someone said, if you leave them too close to the furnace, the heat will warp them, and all sorts of stuff can happen.
Right.
Maybe the label's off-center. We don't know.
Now, of course, this sounds difficult, but once you have a factory... like any factory, it runs like a pretty smooth. Like I know that if you listen to these last 2 shows, this sounds incredibly complicated. Like
you
some
just
sort
take
of a,
each step and you reduce it to its minimum time, and but it has to be done right every time.
It has to be done right every time. And trust me, like we always say, once you do something once or twice, it's not too hard to reduplicate it. And especially if you do it every day, like they did it, especially in the '70s and eighties when records were coming out all the time.
Yeah, when it was actually
just,
a real...
It was almost like just another day at the office and boom, boom, very few mistakes were made.
It was an industry.
So once in their cover, the records are sent through a shrink wrap machine, boxed up and shipped to the music stores, voila. And that's pretty much how a record is made. Simple. Now, the only thing we didn't get to is they talked mostly about digital files. It's the same thing for analog, except it would be analog files that
create the master.
Right.
Yeah.
And analog kicks ass. Someday...
Yeah, they're getting that
now,
right
they're
off the tape.
We're going to end on this because it's a very important point, and we're going to be way over time tonight. That's okay. But a point that I think Rob and I would like to make is that analog tapes, like the one we first recorded on and that we love and every musician who recorded on it loves, will be gone one day. And what I mean by gone is like analog tapes do deteriorate. That's why they're made into digital files. It's just something that will happen. But by the time that happens, all the people that kind of love analog, it won't matter anymore because they'll be gone. It will be like another 50 years, 60 years. All these analog tapes made in the 50s and 60s and 70s will corrode to the point where they're not usable. And a lot of them right now have to take care of are corroding.
Anything made of plastic degrades over time.
Right.
Light is really bad for it. Heat is bad for it.
Exactly right. Nothing is bad for digital. Nothing gets to it. So it sounds doom and gloom because there will be no analog masters at one point in history, and there will be no evidence of analog recordings. But when you get to that point, the people that love analog will be gone. And the people, they'll only be digital people. And the difference... It is perceptible to the people who grew up with analog, but in all seriousness, they're not going to care. These digital people that just like digital and this old fogies who like analog. Time moves on, and it's unfortunate, but they won't care all that much. So that's okay. We got to live with analog, and we got to know the difference. And they'll read about it, but they unfortunately won't be able to, you know.
Well, probably not. They might come up with technology which can, in fact, give an accurate
or duplicate
recording of the sound.
What you're saying, I think, is duplicating an analog without needing the master, which is, you know, you can maybe have a record, make it really clean, you got your analog recording, and you can duplicate that almost exactly, if not exactly like the record, and you don't need the master analog record. You can even use the record. Hopefully that comes along so we never lose analog.
I'm mostly just thinking if they can make improvements in using computers to record so that they can actually get analog-like results.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Currently now it's broken down into sound packages and you have a certain amount per second. And
what's another topic we're going to get to in the future is, of course, something that happened when we had a little break here was... for a couple weeks since the last show was, I know we're really over time. We haven't even got to the record yet. But what Rob is talking about, which the greatest analog company, which is Mobile Fidelity, or as they're called, MoFo. Not
MoFo.
Sorry, they're not called
MoFi.
MoFi. are coming under extreme heat, which we will talk about, for using their, which they have always said, and it's what I've known since I was a kid, when they made their first Mobile Fidelity recording in 1977, was everything's from the master or analog tapes, and everything is analog, and it's as pristine as you can get. This was found out just in the last couple months, maybe more now when you hear this show, that they lied, and that they took their analog masters and made them digital, which has made the analog people who spent lots of money, you pay a lot of money to get a MoFi recording, a Mobile Fidelity recording. And a lot of people who buy every one that comes out because it's 100% analog are actually have a lawsuit against them because they're not buying digital. And we're going to talk about that on a future episode, but it does coincide with what Rob is saying, is that hopefully one day we will get to the point where we can take those analogs and make them digitally sound exactly like an analog. It doesn't sound exactly like an analog. They even described in the article that I read, I think in Rolling Stone, how it does lose a little bit of something. It loses the warmthness, even by transitioning from analog to digital, which is what they do when they make records now, which is why I have told you since this show started, if you want to buy a record that's made after like 1988, it's going to be digital. And even if it's made from analog, it's going to be made into digital files. So it's not going to sound as warm as if you bought an album before 1988 around that time. So I've always recommended buy your records before 1988, after 1988. Yeah. You're better off buying CDs because a CD will sound exactly like it's not the vinyl, people, that makes it sound so warm. It's the analog that makes it sound warm. And if it's digital, even if it starts analog, like from a 1965 Beach Boys record, if they put it into digital files, which they almost always do, if you buy like a reissue nowadays, don't buy the reissue. I know it costs more to buy like an old copy, but buy it because it will sound, I have heard it from my own ears. I told you about the Roger Daltrey story,
Yeah, that's an amazing.
My friend gave me, I'll do this story really quick. I hate doing this every week because it sounds like I'm rushing everybody who's listening. But a friend of mine gave me real cheap 4 Roger Daltrey records. I was so happy they were on CD. I listened to them. I didn't like them. I said, I like Roger Daltrey. These don't sound good. These records are terrible. I somehow bought those 4 records on records at the used store. They sounded magnificent. They sounded completely. And then I realized, oh, okay. Now I understand the difference between an analog record and an analog digital record and mastering. And trust me, I can't say this enough. Don't buy a record nowadays or even a reissue made past, let's just say 2000 or 1990 or whatever, thinking it's going to sound as warm as when you bought your Rolling Stones record in 68. It's not. It's going to probably maybe sound good enough that it's, but to the person who's lived with analog, you got to buy the pressings that only had analog and did not have digital files yet. So important. As I always say, before 1988, get the record. After 1988, get
it's all the same.
It's all the same. It is all the same. After 1988, records, CDs, all the same. You're not going to get the warmthness. It's the analog that makes a difference, or the digital, really. The digitization of the analog tapes will change it. So that's another lesson. I know I've said it before, but it's very important to remember, because I know there are people buying things because they say that vinyl makes it sound warmer. Vinyl does not. It's analog.
Yes.
And we are on the analog bandwagon because we love analog so much. We got the rare privilege in our lives right at the end of the just before CDs became everything, that we got to record an analog. And it's one of my biggest takeaways from being a musician, is to be able to say, we got to record 100% analog, and it was fantastic. It was fun, and it was so, I don't know. It just reminded me.
The machinery, the big 24-inch or the 2-inch reel-to-reel tapes the 80-some tracks.
And I know it's funny because the reel-to-reel tapes and usually be 15 IPS cost so much money. So much money. And
they're big bastards.
They're big bastards, and you got to put them in the machine and everything, but they sound so good. And yes, you try to cut down all the takes and chop it up. The record companies, luckily, they just run the tapes. They just run the reel-to-reel tapes. They didn't care. They count it off or whatever, or discount it. But when you're an independent band and you're paying for everything, have to cut out the in-between chatter and the false takes, and that usually the big
bands keep
in. There's
a bunch of stuff you can't afford because you got limited time on that tape.
Or you only have 4 minutes on the tape and you say, we can make a take because we don't want to start a new one.
We can do it double time.
So we got to get to the album. Unbelievably late here. Our album in the spotlight this week is from music legend Stevie Wonder, and his album from late 1972, Talking Book. Now, I don't know how much I have to say about Stevie Wonder. It's like trying to talk about Elton John. Like, it's, he was the, I said this on the, I don't know if it was the last show where we did Smokey Robinson, like Stevie Wonder, if you didn't live through the 70s, was huge. His songs were played all the time on the radio. He was the equivalent of Elton John. You don't get that nowadays. You really don't, you know, I don't know why his legacy, because maybe his music was, I don't know. Maybe because his music was a little bit more complicated. It was, it just, but I'm telling you, when he, in the 70s, it was like, you know who's a real genius? Everybody would say it. Stevie Wonder. Can't wait for his next album. Oh, Stevie Wonder. And then you'd get an album and there'd be five singles off it. Or at least they'd be playing five songs off every album. He was just everywhere. Then the 80s started. And not only did this guy who was making a classic album every year, he just, not only was he not making classic albums, but he was not making albums all of it. And it's never been the same since the 70s. It's just kind of like, it's almost like he just gave too much in the 70s. And then all of a sudden we're getting three albums every decade. And one of them had I Just Called to Say I Love You on it, which I have said before, I think is the worst hit song ever written by a major artist. And, but let's not dwell on that part. Let's dwell on the 70s. Which were as key an era of albums that he made as the Stones between 68 and 72, when they made Beggar's Banquet, to Exile on Main Street, to the Beatles between Rubber Soul to Abbey Road. Stevie Wonder, from the time he made his album Music of the Mind to Songs in the Key of Life, is one of the greatest series of albums in music history. It ranks right up there with what I just said about the Beatles and the Stones. So, really quickly, you all know, you should know Stevie Wonder was born blind on my birthday, but not on the day of my birthday. Obviously, I'm not that old.
We share the same birthday.
We share the same birthday, and he was born in 1950. He was blind almost from birth, and he was a prodigy, as everybody knows, and he was signed at the age of 11 by Motown's Tamla label, which is pretty much Motown, but it's just a different division, where he was given the professional name Little Stevie Wonder. And then he had a hit single right off the block with Fingertips, which was a number one hit for an 11-year-old or 12-year-old on the Billboard Hot 100. It's pretty nice.
Hey, there was a singing nun back then.
He was making him the youngest artist ever to top the chart. It's a great song, Fingertips. One thing I always didn't understand was that every time it was played on the radio, ever since I started listening to music, it was always called Fingertips Part 1. And I was always wondered, what does Fingertips Part 2 sound like? Well, it only took me 45 years to find out that the reason it's called Fingertips Part 1 is that the song was about 6.5 minutes long, and on the A side was half the song, and on the B side was the other half, and they put it in Part 1 and Part 2, so there is no Fingertips Part 2, it's just one long song. And we got to hear the first part of the song, and that's why it's called Fingertips Part 1, if anybody wants to know about that trivial piece of trivial.
Yeah, you had to buy the single.
And then Motown, of course, just like they do, they wanted him to sound like Ray Charles. They didn't know what to do with him. He's a young kid. Barry Gordy made him record an album called Tribute to Uncle Ray, which is all Ray Charles songs. Then he would record, he recorded an instrumental album. Pretty mediocre albums. Didn't know what to do with them, and they wanted to make him as popular as they can. A lot of strings, pretty much strings on his record. As I make it sound as palatable, And then he made a beach album. And I was like, oh, and I've heard all these albums, and some of them are good, and some of them are dreadful. Because
this appeals to the kids. He's a kid. He'll do the kid music.
Yeah, kind of like the guy's a prodigy, but they didn't seem to. He didn't have much control.
They didn't know what to do with him.
They didn't know what to do with him, and he didn't have any control. In 1970, he finished his contract with Motown, and he said, "I want to do everything." He said, "I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to play on every album. I want to make it my own album. I want to write all my own songs, or I want to pick the songs. I want to do everything." And Barry Gordy says, "Well, if the difference between that and losing you, well, we're going to sign you. You do whatever you want. You're a genius." And so he made the album that everybody figures was the start of his independence was the album just before Talking Book, which is Music of My Mind. And then he made this album, Talking Book, in late 1972. And that's the album we're going to talk about. It's really his breakthrough album as an acknowledged genius. And I thought I knew about this album. I didn't know about this album until I listened to it. I did not know that this album was almost completely keyboards, which is just a mind fuck to me. I was just like, you mean all this music is being done basically by Stevie? And this is not easy in 1972 on a synthesizer to create the sound you want. It might take you a week just to create the sound you want, let alone recording.
This is some of the most wonderful experimentation I've ever heard.
Yeah, this is where the synthesizer took up a whole room and 6,000 chords that you would plug in. And so when I listened to this album the first time, I was really not listening so much to the music as to the utter stunningness of hearing this album created by basically one person, basically with very few, no bass, except for the first song, You Are the Sunshine of My Life. The bass is being played on the keyboard.
I thought that was weird because I was listening to, I think, the next song, the second song, and listened to the bass. Like, what kind of effect does he have on that?
Yeah. I said that so many times on that.
They don't let me have effects. They let him have effects.
Okay, George. And the thing that got me a couple times, I remember the song, I was listening to the song like Big Brother and Blame It on the Sun, and I'm going, wow, they got acoustic guitar on there. Oh, no, that ain't acoustic guitar. That's a clavinet. And I'm going, how does he make a clavinet sound like an acoustic guitar? And many times I was like Rob, I was going like, how does that sound come out? Like, how does that sound like such a band that is playing all electric instruments when it's really just him playing the keyboards? And it's just like, it stunned me. I didn't come out with a big effect on first listen of the songs. I was just stunned about, wow, this is ahead of its time even now. Like, you can't create this music, one guy. And you don't even realize, the greatest thing that you can say about Stevie Wonder, and I think that he would agree about this, is that you totally forget he's blind. Is that he does so much stuff, I totally didn't even think about that he's doing all this as a blind person. They say that's the greatest compliment you can give to a person who's, you know, has no legs or is blind or can't hear.
Yeah, if he was blind and he just had a blues guitar, I wouldn't think so highly of him. But playing, making these sounds and pretty much innovating on the synthesizer like this. Wow, that took time and it took an ear.
It took an ear. It was... I'm still stunned with it. I will be stunned by this album probably until my last breath, because I had heard all through my listening years that Stevie Wonder played all the instruments, and I just thought that that meant that he played the guitar and blah, blah, blah. And oh, okay, you know, that's pretty good for a blind person. But then when I hear that he's playing all these keyboards and making it sound like a band with his drumming, by the way, he's a very good drummer.
Yeah,
I'm going like, wow, this is almost too much. This is almost too much genius to take. Like, I can't do this with sight and my abilities. I can't come close to something like this. I'm just in awe of this album as I'm hearing.
If I had access to equipment,
even with everything that you could give to me, I couldn't make this album. And that's why it's so just like mind blowing to me. And another thing that I learned on this album, I learned a couple things that I thought I knew, but I did not. He doesn't sing, even though I've heard You Are the Sunshine of My Life 1,000 times. I did not know that he didn't sing that first line. That was done by one of his backup singers. I knew that one of his lady backup singers sang the second line, and then he actually comes in and the verse, because the song starts with the chorus. You are the sunshine of my life. And that's not him. I don't know why. I'm not here to question why he decided to have his...
Yeah, and the backup singer sounds almost like him so much that you didn't know.
Yeah,
so
exactly. And then why he had his woman backup singer, not his wife, who writes a couple of songs in Six Background, but a session singer, sing the next line, and then he comes in. It's great, but I just don't understand. I'm not going to try and understand a genius mind. I've just never knew that. I've always assumed that first line was him singing You Are the Sunshine of My Life. And he doesn't, the backup singers don't sing after that. They just sing that, and he does all the vocals, the verses and choruses himself after that. I don't understand it, but it's not for me to understand. It works. And there you go. And then it goes into like, oh, fuck. See, this album just floors me. Then it goes into like Maybe Your Baby, where it kind of starts. It's got this really cool, evil type of chorus where he's kind of singing. And then it goes, the girl's singing, which is so brilliant. He hears things that I just don't understand. Where he goes, maybe your baby is...
That was going through my head for a couple days at work.
New.
And that is the most evil thing to have going through your head if you suspect your partner of cheating.
I know.
I got no partner, and I still thought, oh my God.
And he makes it sound so evil. And you know, maybe your baby has found something.
Use that demon voice.
Yeah, and it's just
it's not the
so
low
cool.
demon voice, it's kind of the higher demon voice.
Now, not every song for me was like out of this world, but every song sounds out of this world, if you know what I mean.
Yes, there is a few songs. I'll give you one example. Tuesday Heartbreak, after listening to it a few times, I kind of broke down the melody and the lyrics, and I thought, you know, that's just kind of an average song. It's not that great. But you don't know it by listening to it.
You nailed it right there. Like Tuesday Heartbreak for me is the weakest song on the album, of an album that's full of fantastic songs, by the way. But on this album, it's the weakest song. But when you hear it, you go, hey, this is a pretty great song. Because it sounds so good. And it's so... I mean, you have to listen to it. It's hard to put into words. It's hard to put genius into words. But when you can make an ordinary song which they say you can't do. I don't believe that.
I don't believe it. No, if you got a really good band, they can make a bad song sound
good. Yes, I do believe that that's true. He makes this not a bad song. He makes a very mediocre song in the context of what's going on around him into something that's actually quite captivating to listen to over and over again.
The way he has layered sounds and the sounds he's chosen on this album are not like anything I've ever heard.
I just want to point out everything is this album. This album really, to be cliche, blew my mind. It's just like, how can any one person, I don't care if he's blind or whatever, make an album like this? Paul McCartney made an album, and Paul McCartney is a certifiable genius. Anybody would tell you that. Paul McCartney has made 3 albums just by himself, and none of them are close to this. And I love all 3. But none of them are close to this because there's so much ingenuity involved. Yes. Paul was just playing pop songs.
He was trying to make it, you know, just the perfect song. This I view very much as a vehicle for Stevie Wonder's sound experiments.
Yes. Yes.
That, yes. I think, is the dumbest thing on the album.
It didn't seem to take long. Like, this album should have took 2 years to make, and it seemed like it took a couple of months. And I don't understand it. The level of just brilliance on this is staggering, to get the right sound, and it always is the right sound.
Some of the background vocals or instruments, how they pop in and pop out at the perfect times.
Oh,
you don't even suspect that you know they should be there, but wow.
Now I want to talk about, and I know that Rob does. We want to talk about one of our favorite songs of all time, because it's fascinating how this came to be. It's, of course, Superstition, which is
Superstition. That's the one thing about Stevie Wonder is every time when I was young, if Superstition or Higher Ground came on the radio, it got cranked.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I listen to Stevie Wonder's hit songs over and over again, never get tired. And Superstition, I have heard since I was 12 years old all the time. Rob's right. It always goes full blast, and I'm always just exuberant when I hear it. It just makes you feel so good. And there's a thing about 2 songs on this record. Most of these songs are about love, and they're very basic, actual lyric wise. Even though they're not basic love songs, as you can tell by Maybe Your Baby, but they are just basic love songs. But there are two songs right in the middle, which is Superstition and Big Brother, which deviate from it, and you can tell right away, like, the deviation. Big Brother is about government watching over you.
Yeah, the one line in there made me think that he might have been listening to a TV commercial or something during election time, and here's white politicians trying to get votes from a black neighborhood.
Oh, it's definitely about Nixon, and especially the last line about I don't have to do anything because I'm paraphrasing here. But, you know, I don't have to do anything because you're going to topple your own government, which is exactly what happened with Nixon. And there's no doubt in my mind that that's about the Nixon government and watching everybody, watching poor black people. Oh, my God. Yeah, what are they going to do? They got nothing. That's what the song's about. But they stand out, and it's such a great song. But I want to talk about the making of Superstition, which is... So Jeff Beck was a huge fan of Wonder's music, and Stevie Wonder was told of this, and prior to booking the Talking Book sessions, though at this point, of course, he was playing all of the instruments by himself virtually, Wonder did like to have other guitarists play on this record. There's only 2 guitars on this record, 2 guitar songs. Ray Parker Jr., plays guitar on I think it's Maybe Your Baby.
Maybe someone good is playing on that.
Ray Parker, as everybody knows, is Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
He wrote Ghostbusters. And this is when he was a session musician, and he's wailing away on the guitar on Maybe Your Baby. And the only other one is Jeff Beck plays guitar, and he plays a solo that I would just kill to play. I mean, the guy comes in and he's on, not even on his own record, and he plays a killer solo on Looking for Another Pure Love.
Yeah, that's
just beautiful.
I stopped and listened. I thought, there's something unusual with that guitar solo. That's not...
That's not a regular guitar solo.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like, when Jeff Beck plays a solo, and you can say that about Clapton and Jimmy Page, like, when those guys play a guitar solo, it goes beyond a guitar solo.
It's a guitar solo.
just almost just every time I heard it, just, you know, made me go, ooh, wow. So he only had two guitars on this album is what I'm saying. But Jeff came into the sessions and he wanted to work with Stevie. So between the album sessions, they were kind of working with each other. And it was actually Jeff Beck, as they were kind of trying to find ideas, he came up with the opening drum beat, which is a great drum beat that Stevie plays on the record. It's very simple, but it just knocks you because it's very strong.
Grabs the ear.
It grabs the ear.
It lets you know something's coming.
It does. I was just about to say that. It lets you know that something is coming and it's going to get pretty funky. And so Wonder told Beck to keep playing while he improvised over the top. Now, this blows my mind, okay? They got nothing planned. And so Jeff Beck comes up and he's on the drums and he's playing this drum lick, and Stevie just goes, keep on playing, man, because I'm going to see. So he improvised most of this song, including the riff, on the spot, right then and there. And then he came up with the words, the superstition about how he was upset that people rely on superstitions to get through their lives and how that's a waste. And it is not only is the song, I think, one of the greatest songs of all time. Rolling Stone rated Superstition, let me check, the number 73 greatest. Sorry, it was re-ranked in 21 as the 12th greatest song of all time. I agree with that. It's right up there. I just think it's one of the greatest songs ever done. Like Rob said, you cannot hear that song and not love it every time you hear it and crank it.
The radio goes up, man. You feel good.
And no matter how many people do it on guitar, which was intended because Stevie Wonder was going to give the song, did give the song to Jeff Beck. Jeff Beck, with his three-piece, had troubles negotiating with the record company to release their album. So Berry Gordy said, release that motherfucker, man. Like, literally, release that motherfucker because it's deadly. Like, and you, Jeff won't be mad because he's in negotiations. He can't release it right now. So Stevie got to release it and put it as a single before Jeff did. Jeff's version is great, but I always think that every version pales in comparison to that clavinet. Just going,
yeah. Bah, bah.
And the horns, these aren't just horns going bah, 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 bah. These are horns with definite parts. When the song comes to a major or a minor part, the horns go, nah, 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 like in a very... a minor chord way, which is just brilliant. Everything is about this song is brilliant, and yet it was improvised on the spot. I can't understand that. That's like the greatest jam session ever, if that ever happened to us.
These guys were on a good wave that day, man.
That's when you're on a good wave. Yeah. It really is, yeah. And you're having a good day, and Jeff's coming up with stuff, and Stevie's coming up with stuff. And at the end of the day, you got one of the greatest songs ever recorded. And everything about this song is just, I could talk about this song for the next hour, but everything about this song, the horns, the great vocal, the great lyrics. I'm not going to go over the great lyrics because we just don't have enough time, but I just love the lyrics about the baby. And it's just actually, for a song that's made up on the spot, is just shows, obviously they must have fine-tuned it once they got it and put in some lines that they liked. But it's just, I can't talk anymore about it. It's just, anything more I say diminishes the song because it's just, and then you got the whole second side left. And it doesn't, you know, second side is really, really a great side. And I love the vocals. I just want to, my last statement here, sorry, Rob, is that the last song, he has this great melody. The song's called I Believe. When I Fall in Love, It'll Be Forever. And he just has this great melody. And they sing this song. And he only sings like two verses and a couple of choruses. And then it fades out for like 2 minutes. And you think it's going to fade out like this Hey Jude type thing. Because it just keeps on saying, I believe when I fall in love, it'll be forever. Blah, 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 over and over again. And then in the last 30 seconds, it changes and goes up tempo. I go, wow, man. Like, I wouldn't, I first of all, I wouldn't do it because it's it does have that Hey Jude vibe to it. But it actually works because it kind of like ends the album as this kind of like funky type of thing on an up note instead of, you know, kind of like a ballad note. And I'm saying, this is a guy in his prime. This is a guy who cannot do wrong.
Yeah.
So I give it, there. I give it 5 out of 5. I'm stunned by this album. And even though, and you know, when you get stunned by an album and give it 5 stars, which is the most we can give it, and you still say there's 1 or 2 mediocre songs on it, tells you how great the album is.
I like this album start to finish, pretty much. Like I said, yeah, some of the songs, lyrically, I thought he's a good lyricist. He's not a great lyricist in that he comes up with a really good idea, but he doesn't really expand on the idea too much.
On this album, anyways, we're talking about.
Yeah.
He of course, had great songs like Living for the City and Boogie on Reggae Woman, where he became a very good lyricist. What was that? Oh, Higher Ground. Oh, great lyrical stuff. But on this album, I totally agree with you. He has his idea, but this is not a lyric album.
Yeah, he's not expounding on it too much. And some of the lyrics he'll pull out, you kind of labor the point. They're there to fill in the space a bit. And that's about the only fault, but you don't notice it when you listen to it.
That's the greatness, isn't it? Is that you know that, oh, you know what? The lyrics just, you know, they're kind of like not as good as the music at this moment. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But you don't care. But you don't care.
No, the one thing that really grabbed my ear was just the experimentation. I found myself every day, I'd have a different song going through my head. So that's how they grew on me. Kind of one song at a time. And I gave it a 4.5. I didn't give it a 5. Ooh. I gave it a 4.5.
I didn't expect that. I actually thought you were going to give it 5. I really did.
I love it. I view it as a vehicle for his experimentation. I was thinking back of the Temptations album, and that had kind of good songs and less good songs, but that was a vehicle for the Temptations voices there. That was the most important thing there.
I have to point out the people who don't follow us all the time.
That was 2 albums ago.
No, what I meant was Rob doesn't give too many 5-star albums. I don't think you've given many at all 5 stars. And I'm not saying that this doesn't deserve.
I have a few.
But you have given a few, but you are very reticent to give 5 stars unless you really feel it. So,
yeah, as much as I love the actual sound and the experimentation.
I'm not demeaning that at all. I'm just saying that just the facts that you really have to feel 5 stars to give it 5 stars.
Yes. Know? About half the songs really grabbed me, and the other half grabbed me less so for the actual songwriting, but quite a bit for the music and the choice of sounds and
yeah, we agree.
Mixing and production musically, and everything
musically and production, like you say, everything musically, production, all the stuff that is encompassed in this record, except for lyrics.
I think it might just be a lot of their love songs and
yeah, that actually surprised me because I'm used to hearing all the songs that that he would later write after this album where they were either political or they had more to say. Actually most of his songs weren't love songs after this, you know, Boogie on Reggae Woman, like I was saying, and Higher Ground and Living for the City and Sir Duke, you know, were not love songs. And so I was surprised that this album, except for 2 songs, was all love songs, is the only weak spot. And because they're kind of one note, like you said, lyric-wise.
And for me, that's a preference. I can't call it a weakness. I can only call it a preference.
I do like, you know, like the switch, like with Maybe Your Baby. It's so, like, his songs are very, on this album, are very hopeful. You know, You and I, We Can Conquer the World, and You've Got It Bad, Girl. You don't tell me.
I believe when I fall in love, it will be forever.
Yes. You're looking for another pure love. Like, they're very positive love songs. And then there's Maybe Your Baby, which is so evil. And it tells you the future of what he was getting more complicated lyric-wise. And this was kind of the start of it, you know, with Superstition and Big Brother and Maybe Your Baby. You could see, yeah, maybe the time for writing love songs is passing, because you have to imagine he was just 2 years ago was, you know, doing a whole, every album was love songs. And because that's what Berry Gordy kind of wanted and gave him. And
yeah, and I mean, preaching. That's
I guess a lot of the music was evolved, but he was still yet to get away from that love song type thing. That would be, he was definitely wanted, you could hear that.
He had more things to say.
He had more things to say.
The love songs weren't going to allow him to say a bunch of stuff.
And he was only like
22.
Yeah. So by his next album,
he was a young fella.
When he was 23, he started to talk like, you got to give the guy credit because he's only 22. And if he writes, still writing about love songs, he's only fucking 22 years old. And he's getting to that. But even the next album, when he's 23, he's starting to write political songs and other type of songs. But this musically is production-wise. And like we said, Rob, everything
amazing goddamn album.
Amazing.
I can't think of even coming close to doing anything like this.
It's jaw-dropping as a musician to listen to this. It's just, I can't think of any other words than mind-blowing and jaw-dropping to listen to this album. I've known about this album for 45 years. I've never listened to it, but I've known how great it was, and I was expecting something more like the hit singles, and it wasn't. It was more. It was actually, how does this guy, any guy, create this by himself, let alone a blind guy? Greatest compliment I give is I never imagined him being blind through this whole record.
Those horns and harmonies, I mean, that's 3- and 4-part writing. And it's complex 3- and 4-part.
You're right. You're not talking just a basic song. You're talking about, oh, there's this part of the song, then there's the horn part. Yeah. Oh, and then there's the doubling.
Sometimes things just come in for like after one line, and then they're gone.
I know. Just like he puts in that little coda at the end of the last song, yeah. I believe. And it's cool. He didn't have to do that, but he felt that had needed to be done. That's a guy in the prime. That's a guy who's so much there. You know,
my brain can only put together more basic stuff.
No, me too. I can't think that. I can't think on that level. Complex. And you know what? I'm not a genius. I listen to this album and I smell genius. You can't be a musician and not listen to this record and say, okay, this is genius here. And what I do may be good, but it ain't genius. So we highly recommend this album. Yeah. But I don't even know what this record is. It's
brilliant.
It's R&B. It's pop. It's got rock. It's I call it Stevie Wonder music because I don't find it definable. I still don't know what it's called because it has a whole new sound to it that's still 50 years later. It has been 50 years, actually, since this release. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't think of anything similar.
No,
a lot of albums I can say, well, this sounds a bit like these guys, or this has echoes of this in it. No, I'm getting no vibes. This is
I've never heard
Stevie Wonder.
I know. This is Stevie Wonder music because I can't say this sounds like anything else that I've ever listened to. I mean, it's not that it's got strange verses or choruses. It's just the music being played and the just the total love of the freedom he has. You can hear the love of the freedom that he has to create. And he doesn't create anything avant-garde or experimental out there. He creates it within the song format to make it to still be commercial. I don't know. The more we talk about this, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it at that. It's just a fantastic album. It was a pleasure to listen to every time.
Exactly.
It grew on me. And it keeps the ears entertained. There's just stuff you're going to miss the first time you hear it that you might hear the second time, and stuff you missed the first two times you might hear the third time.
This is an album you could be playing 20 times.
It's jam-packed with
It is jam-packed with stuff that you could hear it 30 times and you still find something. And I love albums like that. We could be breaking a record here for longest show ever if I don't wrap it up here pretty soon.
Okay. I've said all I have to say. Great record.
We've had this is a great show. Again, we talked way too much about stuff, but we have to, or else we feel really bad when we don't get everything out.
Yeah.
So that's all for today's show. Now, next week we will be on. We won't be on as we are taking a week off, but we will be back in 2 weeks with a new episode and a brand new theme, which we already know which it is, and it's going to be fun.
And that's going to be podcast 150, so I'm going to get drunk.
Yeah, and it will be show 150 for everybody, so we will be drunk or half drunk. And I'll tell you right now, the new theme is either going to be a lot of fun for us or musical torture, as Rob knows.
I'm pretty sure most of you have not heard the albums we're going to be doing.
No, it's way deep down on the record collection. So until then, we will not break the record tonight, thank God. I'm tired of breaking the record for longest shows. So until then, take care and stay safe. Just right or wrong.